From Studio B, the radio studio in USC, in the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, this is The Hot Seat, and you're with me, Max Schwartz. It starts right now. We are back to the phone, and on it today, I have California State Senator for the 37th District, John Morlock. How are you, Senator Morlock? Thank you for calling into The Hot Seat today.
I'm doing good, Max. Just a little head cold, but otherwise I'm fine.
Oh, good. And the 37th District essentially runs from parts of Anaheim down to Silverado Canyon, all the way west to the Pacific Ocean between Orange, Tustin, and Huntington Beach, and Foothill Ranch, Lake Forest, and Laguna Beach. Is that correct?
Yeah, we're about half of Huntington Beach, all the way down to the bottom of Laguna Beach, and then inland to Anaheim Hills.
Okay. And you are the vice chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and you are a member of the Committee on Budget and Fiscal Review and the Governance and Finance Committee. I have lots of important... What?
And I'm also on the Public Health and Developmental Services Committee.
Oh, okay. That is not listed on your website?
It's the special session.
Oh, okay. And I have, so now I have lots of important questions and not a lot of time, so without further ado, let's get started. Governor Jerry Brown recently made decisions on a number of important bills ranging from drones to equal pay. What are your thoughts on the governor's decision for both the bills he did sign and the ones he didn't?
As it relates to the drones, I was surprised that he vetoed the bill that would make it a crime, or at least kind of gives firefighters a chance to deactivate drones when they're around forest fires. Haven't quite figured out why he would do that, but he vetoed three of the drone bills, and then he approved the one that kind of came in on your own personal property and snooped around. So kind of an interesting choice of you know, which ones he approved and which ones he didn't. But I'm sure this will be a topic that'll go on for years, because when you have a new technology with interesting reverberations, they just continue to evolve. And so I'm sure we'll see a new group of bills next year and the following year.
Do you agree with the drone bill that he did sign?
A little bit. It's a new area, and certainly those that are being abusive should have, there should be some ability for private citizens to at least react to that. But the journalistic industry had a real problem with it, kind of felt like it was violating their ability to get information.
Yes, and I can understand that. And going back to why the governor did what he did regarding the forest fire bill, he said, and getting involved with first responders, he said he did that because those are already crimes. Isn't it already a crime to get involved or interfere with firefighting and first responder activity, isn't it?
Well, we had a rather lengthy committee meeting on the subject, and we had public safety representatives up and down the state. And so my question that I kept asking everyone that appeared was, why did these people even do what they were doing? And the response was either, well, we didn't actually find the people who were flying the drones, or, yeah, we found them, we talked to them, told them to knock it off, and they left, but we didn't even keep them on hand. We didn't even know who they are. We wouldn't be able to find them again. So it was sort of interesting to try and figure out the psychology of the whole drill. Why would you be flying a drone when planes and helicopters are nearby? So... Go ahead.
Oh, isn't it the fault of the agency then that didn't get information or didn't detain the individuals?
Yeah, in fact, they lamented the fact that they didn't get a little more aggressive with the owners of the drones to push it a little further. So they didn't really have any real life experience or situations where they actually enforced the prohibition of flying a drone around either a fire or a crime scene.
So if they didn't enforce the laws that are on the books about interfering with first responder activity, why would they enforce new law?
That's a great question. Most of the dialogue centered around fire that occurred on the Cajon Pass, where people pulled over. Obviously, they must keep them in their trunks and started to fly them around the fire, but it disabled planes from coming in to... try and snuff out the fire, and then the fire jumped the think it's the 15, and caught a lot of vehicles on fire. It was rather tragic. So a lot of people were really impacted, but real upset. But no one ever pinned down who were the drone flyers and why they were motivated to do it.
But then, so, don't you understand?
So the issue of enforcing an existing law, if there was one, obviously the firefighters didn't know it, or they didn't have manpower to go chasing down who was flying the drone to figure out where it landed and what car it went into.
So if there were, because there were laws on the books, or at least that's what the governor has said, and there is a law about not interfering with policing, the city attorney for Los Angeles has charged an individual with doing that for flying a drone too close to a police helicopter. Do you blame Governor Brown for rejecting more laws if the ones aren't already being followed?
No, I don't. I just found it interesting that, but two things. One is that I don't recall anyone saying that there were existing rules on the books that they could utilize and enforce. And two, because of the lack of that knowledge, this drone bill by Senator Ted Gaines sort of went on a fast track. It went from that committee meeting off to the floor and into the assembly in the last weeks of session. And I think we finally voted on it the final days. So it was sort of fast tracked. So you would think that somewhere along the way, someone would have said, you know, the existing laws are adequate, but that was never said.
Okay. And moving on now to your Senate Judiciary Committee. What are your thoughts on elected judges and retention elections?
Well, just a clarification, Max. The Judiciary Committee doesn't really approve judges. It actually deals with bills that affect civil codes that are of a legal nature. So,
I understand that it doesn't do with judges, but when Senator Hertzberg was on, who is also a member of this committee, I asked him about judges. So I figured it would only be appropriate to ask you, a Republican who's on the committee, a similar question.
Great. I just wanted to make sure that we were dealing with what that committee is all about, and dealing with judges isn't what it's about. And I certainly want to compete with Senator Hertzberg because I have a high regard for him. So I'll answer the question. I've seen abuses where in both strategies, in appointments and in elections. I've been involved in litigation where the public employee unions, my opinion, put a lot of pressure on a judge to rule a certain way because judges have to go up for re-election every 6 years when they're in the Superior Court. So I can see where the system can be abused by appointment or by election. But right now, I'm pretty satisfied with the mix that we have now.
Okay. And continuing on, what in terms of what the committee actually has jurisdiction over, what are you planning for next session?
I have the joy of being the vice chair of judiciary, although I'm not a lawyer. And the chair of that committee pretty much has the staff and resources to run the committee. But because of the partisanship of it all, I'm not included in that activity. So I really don't have an intelligent or deep answer for you. I just sort of get to enjoy what comes before the committee when it comes before them.
Okay, and how did you get placed on this committee if you are not an attorney?
Great question. I don't know. But I was elected in March of this year in a special election and had to wait, you know, about a month and a half before I was appointed to committees and the Rules Committee. Along with, I'm sure, the President of the Senate, Kevin DeLeon, decided that this would be a good fit for me.
Do you feel qualified to be on this committee?
I think so.
Okay. And even though you're in the minority, don't you still lead the Republican sort of agenda of what the committee should do in the minds of your caucus?
Wouldn't that be nice? In reality, that just isn't the case. Pretty much the committees, in my experience, just being there for the last 7 months, most of the work is done by the chairs.
But aren't you the leader of the Republican ideals for the committee, or no?
If I am, then I'm not included in the preparation of the agenda or in selecting what bills go to judiciary or or what kind of projects the staff that man the Judiciary Committee will be focused on. So I would say that's maybe a joy of the party in charge, that they can get, say, extra staff members because they chair a committee, and they can pursue an agenda. But on the whole, the minority party is excluded from that activity.
Okay. But in all fairness, though, you talk about bills that go before the judiciary. Isn't that rules that sends bills to various committees?
Right. But with the staff that's available to the chair, she can also pursue specific agendas that relate to that committee. And she oversees bills that actually are written by the Judiciary Committee and don't really have a specific author like the Ombudsman's Bill.
Okay. And moving on now to your area of expertise, which is finance. You have a CPA license, you serve on two committees related to finance, and you have been the Republican point person on finding money to improve California's infrastructure, one of the two reasons Governor Brown called a special session. What is the status of a deal to fund infrastructure improvements?
The special session did not get any specific tax bills to the floor of the Senate before the session concluded. That special session is being led and chaired by Senator Jim Bell out of the San Jose area, and he's still working on the components that he had offered in his bill early in session, which is now sort of the structure of the special session, where he wants to do several things. One, he wants to raise the car tax by $65 per vehicle, wants to raise gas tax by 6 cents per gallon, wants to raise diesel tax by 12 cents per gallon, wants to find efficiencies at Caltrans. And to date, we really haven't seen any of that come, and I haven't heard of any sessions or meetings being called between now and the end of the year. Although I'm sure both that special session and the public health special session, they could call meetings at any time. Just haven't heard of any advance notice of such. But at this point, nothing's really happened. But when you kind of peel the whole thing back, Max, you see that the state was able to balance its budget in a timely manner, according to Proposition 25. And then the governor said, okay, we've balanced the budget, but now I have two other areas that need to be addressed and need more revenue. So what you'll do is you look at what's been happening with the budget for Caltrans, which oversees transportation. And for the last 11 years, that budget has averaged about $10.5 billion. There hasn't been any movement upwards to show that the state has been very concerned about roads and highways up and down the state. And so you look a little deeper, you look at the revenue source, and you see that the gas tax has actually been going up every year. But the overall budget has been staying level, which means that the state has been diverting its own money or skin in the game and putting it elsewhere. And I would postulate that it's been going into the pension plan. So now the governor is saying, I need a new tax. Well, the tax is not because the state has been neglecting roads because of lack of money. It's just been neglecting roads because it's been diverting money to pay for pensions. So you might see that it's called a pothole tax, but it's actually, in fact, a pension tax. So it's a little disingenuous to have a special session to try and raise taxes elsewhere when you really need to figure out how to fix the entire budget, which is not happening. So I think we need to figure out how to improve Caltrans. Caltrans is spending 3 times the national average per mile on maintaining our roads. $70,000 per mile is spent on administration. The Legislative Analyst Office came out with a report in May of 2014, more than a year ago, stating that Caltrans has 3,500 employees too many, not 35, not 350, but 3,500 architects and engineers that don't need to be there. So last month, state auditor came through and realized that one of their engineers was golfing as much as he could. In fact, put in 55 golf days on state time within an 18-month period. So why not? Why not golf if you don't have any work to do? So we have a lot of trimming and efficiency opportunities within our bureaucracies before we start going to the taxpayers and asking them to pay more for the road.
Okay, and two points there. One is you make it seem like the special session is over, but according to members of the assembly I spoke with, it can be called back. It's not over, and it can be called back into session at any time at the will of the chair. Is that correct?
That's what I said. We just haven't been notified when or if it's going to meet between now and the end of the year. We have yet to meet after the end of session, which was on September 11th.
Okay, and going back to the gas tax, if there are less cars on the road that use gasoline, and if the Democrats were willing to make a guarantee that money would only be used toward or put toward actual infrastructure improvements, why wouldn't Republicans or yourself leading the charge for this be for it?
So now you're touching on, I think, a very interesting area, and that is we've got Senate Bill 350 that was signed this week by the governor saying we'd like to transfer over more of our electricity manufacturing from carbon-based, gas-based resources and go to solar and wind. And one of the things that was not in that bill was we want to reduce the amount of gasoline that's sold in this state by 50%. So it's a little bit of a disconnect when you say on one hand we want to raise gas taxes and on the other hand you want to say we want to reduce gas consumption by 50%. But when you go back to my prior comments that maybe it's a management issue when it comes to Caltrans and how it's financed, if the governor is so busy trying to transition people over from gas-powered cars to electric-powered cars, then where are the resources going to come from? And all you're looking at then is just nonstop increases in taxes. And then when you take into account that maybe the money has actually been diverted from roads into pension plans, maybe it's time not to just look at a gas tax, but to look at the overall structure, something that the whole tax system and how we're generating revenue for the state, not only now but going forward. And that's something that Senator Hertzberg is looking at, and he's trying to say, you know, what can we do differently as we raise taxes for the state? He's looking more at a sales tax for service industries, which is dicey, but at least he's attempting to get a good dialogue going. And I think that's a whole better discussion than to try and find a tax for every little problem that comes up, whether it's a gas tax or a managed care organization tax or you know, you name the soup of the day.
And even so, going back to your comment about SB 350, wouldn't it make sense that because in terms of supply and demand, or in terms of supply, if the supply of cars that take gasoline is supposed to be decreased, to fill the void in the revenue, wouldn't it make sense that taxes need to be increased?
But isn't it a little awkward that you're asking to increase the tax on gasoline, which is supposed to be a declining fuel source, yet we've got electric cars that are paying anything at all, and they're using the roads, and yet they're probably heavier than normal cars. So they're probably putting more stress and strain on our infrastructure than gas-powered vehicles. So you've got a big disconnect here.
So would you want to impose a tax on the amount of on the electricity bills for the amount of electricity used to charge electric vehicles?
I have proposed that in governance and finance, and Senator Hertzberg had a lot of fun with it and teased me pretty thoroughly over it. Yes.
So it's something you've tried that Democrats won't let happen?
It's something that I proposed, but I haven't put it in the bill because I was elected after the due date for writing bills. But I think we are giving such deference to one industry, and that is the electric car, that we ought to be looking at how does it take care of its fair share of the roads that they're impacted. I don't have the answer yet, but taxing electricity at charging stations might be something we should be looking at.
Is that something you'd propose in the next session?
It's not in my top 20 that I'm working on, but I'd be happy to consider it.
Can you share then any of the top 20 so the listeners have an idea of what you're working on?
Well, I've got more than 20, and we've been trying to narrow it down and would like to get it to a little more manageable number. But I don't have that list handily in front of me. We're still working on it. But I certainly want to work on some solutions to the pension problem. I want to work again on solutions to Caltrans. Caltrans, I did propose one bill in the special session, and I wanted to try and change the amount of work that's outsourced by Caltrans. Currently, they only do 10%, and they do 90% internally. A good portion of the states in this country do about 50% outsourcing. The Orange County Transportation Authority here in Orange County does about 50%. States like Florida and Arizona do almost 80 to 85% outsourcing. So I'd like to resubmit that bill. It lost on a party line, the Democrats voting no, Republicans voting yes. But if you look at Caltrans, about 54% of their employees are already retirement age or near it. So you can have a nice reduction of workforce by just watching natural attrition with retirement, and they would never see someone being laid off just because you're shifting work over to an outside firm. The other advantage of using outside firms is that when you have downturns in the economy and your funding slows down, then you can go ahead and terminate the relationships with outside firms and not have to make internal layoffs. But the state of California doesn't seem to have a policy of laying off people when there isn't enough work. Hence, the state auditor saying there are 3,500 employees too many at Caltrans. So we offer that as a solution, and we're going to try and provide it again.
Okay, and going back to the special session, something I've asked members of the Assembly, do you, even though other important matters than health care and infrastructure funding have been taken up and bills have been passed and now signed into law, do you believe the special session has been a waste?
I don't know if it's been a waste. I think what's happened is that the reality is that now we have 14 senators that are Republicans, so that's just one over one-third. So we can stop a two-thirds bill requirement, which is necessary to raise a tax. And so if you look at Caltrans, which is spending three times the national average per mile, and we don't have snow and winters here in L.A. or, you know, in this state, so we can't even seem to fix roads as cost-effectively as Michigan does, then how do we, in good conscience, say we should raise a tax anywhere until Caltrans cleans itself up? We've got to figure out how to convince the voters that what they're paying for is righteous. And so that's going to make the special session quite interesting. The public health special session wants to raise over $1 billion in taxes on managed care organizations. Well, this gets a little more complex, but their agendas are already saying that there's going to be winners and losers. So those managed care organizations that don't have Medi-Cal patients will all of a sudden find a pretty serious tax that they're going to have to pay, and that's going to impact their members, and it will affect insurance premiums, and everyone will be having to pay a little more of the burden. And so that's an indirect tax as well on all the consumers. So these are tough things that need to be reviewed, but you've got to at least prove to your constituents that what's being offered it makes sense and it's fair, and right now that hasn't been the case.
Okay. And moving on to, I got one last question because we are running short on time, and I'm asking this because I feel the public has a right to know if they don't already know, and that is, you are a CPA, however, the Board of Accountancy says your license is inactive. Two parts to this. One, do your constituents know it is inactive, and two, will you be renewing it at the end of the year?
I don't know if they know it's inactive. I had kept it active because I always thought I'd be going back to the private sector. In order to maintain a CPA license, you have to get 40 hours of continuing professional education every year, which I did up to about 2 years ago. In fact, I did it. I got 80 hours, but it just got to a point where I couldn't find the time in being a county supervisor and finding 2 weeks out of the year to go to courses. So the answer was just to go inactive. So you'll see that I don't use the CPA behind my name. It's not anywhere in any of my literature or on my stationery. So I have been trained as a CPA. I was a partner in a CPA firm for 10 years. So I certainly enjoyed that career. I'm not so sure, Max, that I want to go back and take 2 weeks of courses to renew the license because I don't use it for any financial benefit. So other than just putting the letters back on my stationery, it doesn't seem like a good use of time right now because this job is certainly keeping me plenty busy every week without having to get what we call the continuing professional education.
Well, thank you very much for that, Senator Morlock, and thank you very much for joining me in the hot seat today. It was a pleasure. The Hot Seat After Hour starts right now. You can email the Hot Seat inbox at thehotseatwithmaxschwartz@gmail.com, or you can tweet me at MaxSchwartzTV. You can subscribe to the Hot Seat's newsletter by clicking on the link on our page. Go to annenbergradio.org/podcast and click on the link underneath the Hot Seat's description and enter your email address. From Studio B in the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, I want to say thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me next time. Good day.